General Duncan, Reel 10. You went to the 1st Light Battalion Perim Down in January 37. Give me a bit of detail about Perim Down as a battalion headquarters and base.
We went into barracks which had been specially built for the Light Battalion to house the three companies with purpose-built hangars, gun stores, quartermaster stores, and so on. They were next door to an old tin-hutted camp, which had also been rebuilt in brick, where the 5th Battalion were lying next door. Then, just down the road, a hut which had been officers' quarters had been converted, and that was where the brigade headquarters were. There was nothing particular about the layout. Both the two camps had very good modern officers' messes, sergeant messes, and brick barrack blocks. And we really, literally, didn't know this was luxury which we'd never even dreamt of before.
Any comments you'd want to make or criticisms as regards workshop facilities and things like that?
No, the workshop facilities were adequate on the scale which tank battalions were given for that purpose. Stores were adequate. Always, of course, as more and more stores arrived, you became more and more cramped. Nobody ever builds the British things big enough. It's rather like the lack of outbuildings in the modern house. As you live and work, so you accumulate more and more stuff, which has got to be stored away somewhere. And the only other thing, this formed a little sort of enclave of its own, and then about a mile and a half away was the site where they were building one of the new wooden hutted militia camps, which were going to be even more luxurious than ours, excellently built on a very good plan, and centrally heated, which ours weren't.
So you felt pretty well provided for?
Mm-hmm.
You felt pretty well provided for?
Oh, yes. We were very, very happy, very contented on the whole. Mm.
Who were the leading personalities in the battalion during 37 while you were with it?
Oh, commanding officer. Commanding officer, Colonel Caunter. Oh, yes, quite definitely. A man of very strong personality, of slightly uncertain temper. Man who knew exactly what he wanted and was going to have it and going to have it jolly fast. From that point of view, he was a very good leader of something like the Light Battalion, which after all was destined for a reconnaissance role and had to move, not only to move, but also to think very quickly.
Did he have any particular specializations or things which he was particularly keen on within the battalion?
No, I don't think he did.
Mm-hmm.
I can't really recall. No, not more than any commanding officer who was determined to see his own battalion was the best at everything. He had a very forceful personality which went a long way towards getting what he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
It was fun to work with.
Good. Was the organisation of a light battalion much the same as the organisation of a medium tank battalion?
Much the same, except of course the old mixed company organisation of 1934. We were a homogeneous battalion. We were all light tanks, and these light tanks were new. Of course, this was the Mark 6B, which was the first three-man tank to come into general service, mounting in the turret a .303 Vickers gun and a .5 Vickers gun for anti-tank work side by side. The anti-tank armament, of course, was inadequate, except well, it was adequate for its purpose. After all, you only expected a light tank to engage a light tank. And nobody had yet realized the complete futility of hoping that the light tank and the heavier armed tank would keep themselves in separate parts of the battlefield.
Most machines have their idiosyncrasies. Well, what was the sort of character of the Mark 6B?
Of the Mark 6B, very fast, requiring fairly delicate handling on the road. It had one brutal characteristic, which was reverse steering, which showed itself to a marked extent in these tanks. Normally speaking, if you pull up your right-hand brake lever on a tank, the tank turns to the right because you're resting the track. On the Mark 6B, with its higher speed, as you pulled the track up, the weight of the tank took charge. The actual sequence of operations is the disengagement of a clutch and the application of a brake. If you only pull it up so as you disengage the clutch and you're running downhill on the overrun, the tank steers the wrong way. It turns to the left instead of the right. Drivers became extremely skilled. One learnt this, and normally speaking, they invariably drove on the with the engine. They changed direction with the engine pulling. But I can remember one occasion where I brought down a hill very fast by my driver, much faster than I wanted to be, and at the bottom of the hill he got out without orders, stopped the machine and got out without orders. I was furious. But he said he went to the front of the tank and opened it, and one of the brakes for the clevis pin at the bottom had fallen out. He brought me down the hill on reverse steering and direct steering by accelerating or decelerating his engine. But we had one or two very nasty accidents indeed on the reverse steering before one realised that for safety you had always to change direction with the engine pulling.
Did it have any other defects?
Characteristics? Defects? No, I don't think it had. It was a very good training machine, actually. Its clutch gave a great deal of trouble. So I must say, to my own immense satisfaction, practically none of my tanks suffered from the... It was the clutch springs which went, and both my fellow company commanders had tank after tank after tank off the road. Trouble was that when this occurred, it was liable to do a great deal of damage to the engine and the clutch, and spares were very, very short indeed. In addition to that, it had a very, very good wireless set indeed, quite excellent. Unfortunately, we couldn't go on with it because it took 95% skilled labour to assemble it, but it was a very reliable set with great range. The other innovation was that it had a searchlight on the tank, and we did quite a lot of experimental firing by searchlight. We're working out the tactics for the handling of the light to confuse the enemy, lining a lot of tanks up together, and illuminating the target in turn, three tanks on either flank, then three in the middle, then three on either side, and so on, which was interesting and I think useful, actually, although it was very, very rarely used during the war.
How did it show itself in the training exercises? I imagine that the pace of movement must have been impressive and...
Well, the pace of movement was impressive. It was very quick. It would do up to about 20 miles an hour, I suppose, quite comfortably, as opposed to the medium tank, whose normal speed was 12. Equally, of course, the light tank, hard driven, would go a good deal more than its rated 20 miles an hour. It was an uncomfortable ride, owing to a curious design defect, which was that the last suspension, the track, the end of the track at the rear was on the ground. Instead of coming round the last suspension wheel and then finally going round an idler which is above ground level, And for some reason or other, that gives you a bumpy ride, and they could give you a very bumpy ride indeed.
Presumably the pace of the machine made new kinds of activities, new kinds of situations possible. Well, what kind of things were you trying out once you got this nice, fast new machine in your hands? Do you remember any particular episodes?
I don't think it made anything... I don't think it made any difference in one's standard manoeuvres or attacks. The only thing was that your encircling flank or flanking movement could be much greater because the time taken over was much shorter. And of course the other thing was that it was a much smaller tank than anything we had before, so it was much, much easier to hide, and the minor incidents of the ground became of greater and greater importance.
You said there were a lot of funny stories relating to driving and handling and operating the new light tank. Which ones did you have in mind?
I was particularly thinking, usually connected with this wretched reverse steering, where people really got into the most frightful trouble descending hills, and the tank would suddenly go out of control, the driver not realising to the immense damage either of buildings or roads or houses, and occasionally vehicles. I remember one particular incident when we were coming home from a long and very, very tiring and trying exercise. Some chap who produced an entirely new Ford car just drove in the middle of the road. And the tank was going down the hill. It couldn't stop. It just started at the offside headlamp, and it went completely down the right-hand side of the tank, of the car, immobilising it, leaving it on the ground. Of course, the most appalling blockage immediately resulted, and as far as I was concerned, it took me an hour and a half to get home after that, because I had to wait. I couldn't get by anybody. They were absolute devils on wet roads. If you tried to stop quickly on a wet road, it was fun all over the place. The thing, of course, which was interesting and fun for the drivers was that it wasn't necessary with a light tank to get permission to go on any road. You can go where you liked. And therefore, as far as they were concerned, their radius of action out of barracks was infinitely greater than it had ever been before. From that point of view, it was a tremendous morale booster to the driver. And instead of spending hours and hours and hours in maintenance, and very, very rarely getting a chance of taking his tank out, he had much less maintenance to do because it was a much smaller machine, had much more opportunity of driving. Equally, your crew, you could get your crew out much more. The trouble, of course, was that from the point of view of the company commander and the troop commander, that almost doubled their work because you had to find something for them to do when they went out. And you couldn't just merely leave them doing the old normal routine jobs, nor could you take them out on the road and merely let them drive from A to B. It was a complete waste of time, of tank track mileage, and also, of course, of crew time.
It must have been a relatively new experience for the local civilian population to find their roads full of trundling light tanks. Did that lead rise to any...
Well, yes and no, but in actual fact, in those days, Tidworth was pretty well hardened to almost anything. You see, if the roads weren't being mucked up by tanks, they'd been accustomed to them being mucked up by horse transporting quantities, guns and the like, slow-moving heavy lorries. Oh, no, I don't think it made a great deal of difference to them. And of course, the only other thing is, we, as far as possible, one got off the road because there was no technical advantage in moving on a road. You used the road just merely as a convenient means of getting from A to B, where you hoped to present your tanks, yourself and your crews, with some new technical situation which would be of some use to them.
Apart from the new tank, ancillary equipment, you've already mentioned wireless, which I take to have been a new wireless with a new machine, and you described it as admirable but impractical. What did you mean by that? Yes, the wireless on the new tank you described as admirable but impractical. What did you mean by that?
Well, because with the numbers which you required in the later expansion, you simply hadn't got enough skilled workmen to put it together. The difference lies between this number seven set, seven and nine set, which were both beautiful sets, which took 95% of skilled labour to assemble them, 5% unskilled, and the 19 set which served us through the whole of the war, which was built with 5% skilled labour and 95% unskilled.
Mm.
That's what I mean. That was the design problem.
Yes.
And, of course, to a very large extent, it also applied to the tank. Those early tanks, although they weren't frightfully good fighting machines, they were beautifully finished, which... when you think that really that one shell finishes the tank off, there's a great deal to be said for the Russian methods who don't finish off their armour plate. They merely leave it rough flame cut. And the American who takes two pieces of tin, welds them together and says, well, after it works just as well as a brass, beautifully finished and turned brass hand wheel.
Mm.
He's quite right too.
Going back to wireless, from the point of view of... the opportunities for coordination and close control. Did the availability of this new set stimulate new developments?
No, it didn't. It merely allowed you to perfect your techniques. What we were always conscious of in a wireless set, especially on the one battalion frequency, where you had to cut your communication down to the absolute limit, there was no opportunity of talking to another tank in your troop and telling him not to be a fool. And equally, there was no possibility of communicating with your driver. You had to fix up devices on your own. Some people put reins literally on their driver's arm, so if you wanted to turn to the left, you tug the left rein and that sort of thing. Others fitted up elaborate switching devices.
What sort of switching devices?
Oh, a row of lights in front of the driver, a red and a green light, white meant slow down and so on. They were all, of course, very nice. They were great fun to put up, quite impractical, because we then had no means of taking the signal from a stationary display set to a moving control platform in the turret, except a long wire. That was all right if you remembered which way you turned the turret. If you didn't, you pulled the whole thing to pieces and probably caused a shorter and further trouble.
From the point of view of its operational usefulness, was this new wireless set that came with the light tank an improvement? And if so, in what kinds of ways?
Oh, yes, it was an improvement. It was a great... cut that one out. It was a great improvement from the point of view of quality of speech and reception and range than the ones that I'd known before with the serving with the second battalion. And the nine set, which followed the seven, was two sets in one, so that you could pre-tune one to one frequency and pre-tune the other one to another frequency. If you were jammed in the first frequency, you merely said change, flicked a switch, and you were on another alternative frequency, which whoever was jamming you had to find.
So it had some enhanced technical capabilities, but I'm just wondering what particular advantage, from an operational point of view, one could make of that improved performance.
Reliability, constant strength of signal. Your range was greatly increased, and your reliability of performance was greatly increased. It all added up to greater control by the battalion commander.
Mm.
No more problems of some wretched company going swanning off in the distance because the signal hadn't come through, and that sort of thing.
Mm. With the tank, did you have any improved armament as well as improved wireless?
Yes. You carried an anti-tank gun as well as an anti-tank 0.5 gun. And those two guns were shoulder-controlled for elevation, as opposed to the medium tank, which had the most fiendish arrangement of our, which one hand resolved in the horizontal plane for azimuth, and the other one resolved in the vertical plane for elevation, so you could train your hands in two entirely unnecessary movements. This one, you merely had one hand traverse, which gave you direction, and a crutch which fitted into your shoulder. You raised or lowered your shoulder, and so you raised or depressed the guns.
This was quite an improvement, was it?
This was a great improvement. And these, of course, were the other thing was that these were the special tank corps pattern Vickers guns, as opposed to the infantry pattern, which had special pistol grips special feed blocks, because normally a Vickers gun feeds from the right-hand side. If you're going to mount two guns close together, see, one of these guns had to have a left-hand feed block. There was one further advantage, as far as we were concerned. The Vickers gun normally ejects its round when it's fired immediately on the ground below the gun. Well, this one had a tube which ejected the cartridges were pushed out one by one into a tray underneath the guns. Made life much easier. We weren't walking about in a pile of brass cartridges in the bottom of the tank.
How did servicing and maintenance time on the new light tank compare with that you'd been used to on the old Vickers medium?
Well, the tank was a good deal smaller. We'd always had special grease guns, an RD pump, actually, a great big pump, which got over the business of dealing with individual nipples with small size grease guns. And except for the fact that the tank was smaller, the greasing operations didn't vary very much, as indeed there were not much more difference between greasing a 12 horsepower Austin of 1938 and a Rolls Royce. It's bigger in scope, but the range of operations is the same.
Is Oddy O-double-D-Y or I-E?
O-double-D-Y. He was an engineer officer, mm-hmm. One of the old engineer officers in the tank corps.
Right. Well, we've been talking about rather basic things so far. Let's talk a little about the sort of work you were doing with the Light Battalion. You were company commander. What was your sort of routine activities and responsibilities in that position?
Well, my object was to produce a company fit for war as we conceived it at that time. This meant the various operations of war, the attack and the withdrawal, the actual method of carrying out reconnaissance, the formation of flank screens, one side or another, and the holding of positions, which after all are the standard jobs which fall to the lot of any tank company, were just accentuated by the fact that, first of all, we were working further out, and secondly, we had the means of moving much faster, so that what you were after, again, was an increase in speed in carrying out all these operations on the principle that speed saves lives.
Did the training program, was it geared to this need for speed and quickness of reaction?
No, I don't. It wasn't. It was a thing which was forced on us by the commanding officer's personality, personally embraced by me because I enjoyed it.
Yes. How was it forced and embraced? I mean, in terms of exercises and
in terms of exercises furious commanding officer saying, why the hell are you taking such a very long time to do a simple operation?
Give me a few examples.
Concrete examples, I can't, but I know that every time, it was very, very rare when you were told to do anything by the commanding officer to be commended for the speed with which you've done it. You were much more likely to be damned for being so-so. Although, in actual fact, nothing could have been done faster. I know that quite well.
You referred earlier to the Allez-Allez scheme.
Oh, yes. Well, is
that part of the general ethos, or does that really represent a formal scheme that was developed at this time?
No, this was a thing where it came under a lot of discussion in the Staff College. It was a scheme which appealed to me because it involved no paperwork. I never saw much point in writing out elaborate paper schemes to take a troop of tanks out and train them. And all I ever did over that was I used to take my car and drive somewhere on the plain. And as I drove, watching the ground, I would imagine that there was an enemy located behind there, or the tank had, our own people had either hit some form of trouble, or alternatively, an enemy formation had appeared. And out of that, you constructed a scheme, the basic outlines of a scheme.
Then, could you illustrate that with a few examples of some of those basic schemes?
Well, I mean, no, it's really not really very easy. But if you imagine a track going up a hill with a bend which takes it behind a wood on the right and some scrub on the left, and a much higher hill on the left-hand side, if you're going to go through that on reconnaissance, there are three things about it. One is you've got to that hill on the left has got to be masked in some way or another, because otherwise you'll be in extreme danger. And the second is that the little clump of wood on the left-hand side is a potential source of danger, and God knows what happens when you get round behind the wood. So what you expect the chap to do, the trooper, the company commander to do, is to send somebody to mask the hill on the left, to send somebody to occupy that patch of scrub, and having occupied the scrub, to get another tank on until you can see round the corner, and then send somebody round the corner. That's the most childish example that you can think of. But if you launch that on 30 soldiers disgorged out of a lorry, it's astonishing how long it takes them to, initially to produce to any form of coherent plan, and it's quite astounding how fast they produce it for you after 3 or 4 weeks of it. Being chased and tongue-lashed for being so, and emphasising continually the need to go on. And then as well as that, you see, you also make them speak the wireless message that they would send. And the chap, from the time the chap gets down to occupy the wood, or he's in position to see around the corner. If you go on, having done the outline of the first thing, you then point to the next chap and say, well, now what's wrong with that? Or do you agree with it? Would you have sent a different wireless message? Would you have done this? What gun would you be prepared with as you go around? These are all, they're all absolute routine things. The chaps have got to protect their own lives and the lives of their comrades under actual war conditions. And all you're trying to do is to make them think of what they are going to encounter if war came.
Yes, you've explained it very clearly and simply for me, and I think I understand it. What I'm not quite sure about is why these kind of methods were innovatory. I mean, they sound like the kind of things you would have been doing earlier. Wherein lies their novelness?
I don't think that there is any particular novelty about it. It was, as far as I was concerned, it was born back Old John Hope used to do that when I was riding home from hunting. Just merely making you think of any piece of ground as a military problem, not merely as a nice-looking landscape.